I would love to see more people care about reactive nitrogen excretion. I think there's a lot of data that shows that, at least in terms of the US total footprint, the dairy industry is a pretty small contributor to climate impacts, but we're a much larger contributor to the ammonia emissions, for example, or other reactive nitrogen emissions. There's a paper in 2021 by Al Rotz that covered all the details for that, but that's something I would like to see a lot more focus on. If I had my way, I think that's a more concerning environmental issue. Not that we can really rank our environmental concerns, but I think they're research-wise could be more focused on nitrogen too.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
All right, welcome everybody to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm your host for today, Gail Carpenter, the State Dairy Extension Specialist at Iowa State University. I am joined today by Dr. Mary Grace Erickson. She is a postdoctoral associate in bioproducts and biosystems engineering at the University of Minnesota. Mary Grace got her bachelor's and master's at Purdue University. She finished her master's degree in 2019. After that, she did a PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and finished up there in 2003. Really excited to chat with Mary Grace today. So tell me more about your position that you're in now and what brought you there.
So I've been at the University of Minnesota for just over a year now. And what I'm currently doing is focused on greenhouse gas emissions from stored dairy and swine manure, as well as on-farm greenhouse gas measurement methods for dairy farms. So we're focused on developing some farm scale measurements. And then finally, I guess, last part would be some sustainability assessment or extension research too. So I had the opportunity with this postdoc to get into the world of extension, which I know is more your territory, Gail, too. I hadn't previously done any extension work during my PhD. I was more focused on teaching and more dairy nutrition research. I had projects on protein nutrition and reactive nitrogen excretion. So kind of the protein nutrition, productivity, environmental output interplay, what is what I'd say my PhD projects were focused on, as well as undergrad education. You probably know my PhD mentor, Michelle Watteau, too, is also very education focused. So kind of have had some blend of interests in social and natural science.
Yeah, Michelle's actually been a guest on the show, I believe. So
okay.
I say that, and I'm 90% sure. I feel like I talk to Michelle very often. So I'm pretty sure I have talked to him in this context, though, as well. I love, well, first of all, before I ask you questions, can we agree that extension people have more fun?
I think I'm learning that through the postdoc that you do get to see a lot of interesting and different things just by being out and about more. I think people, or I didn't necessarily realize with teaching how much it holds you down to campus versus extension. Yep. I've been able to just see a lot more different situations and people, places, things. So it may be fun in that regard.
It keeps it exciting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it keeps you current too. And I think that's always, you don't get stuck in your ivory tower if you're doing extension stuff. Not that I have anything against people who don't do extension, but it's just, it's a fun role mm-hmm. when you get to do stuff with producers too.
Unlike traditional vitamin D3, which requires metabolic conversion in the liver and kidneys before becoming bioavailable, 25-hydroxy-D3 bypasses the first step, allowing for faster absorption and improved efficiency. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/hy-d.
But I'm really excited to talk to you because I'm in the nutrition space, right? Like, I work with mostly the nutritionists. I'm really excited about the rumen and rumen fermentation. And so I love, like, this idea of sustainability. But in the space that I work in, we really tend to focus on, like, the sexy things are, like, what additives can we get? Or how can we manipulate the ration for enteric emissions? And not that enteric emissions aren't important, but there's this huge like chunk of sustainability that's the rest of the farm, right? And that's one of the drums I've been beating a lot, is that you have to think about the whole system and not just about what goes on in the rumen. So what is the distinction between nutrition and nutritional management?
So I think you bring up a good point about like the animal level versus farm level. And I don't know if this is too much of a conceptual thing to get stuck on or hung up on, but like to me, I think we all look up to the nutrition work that was done in the early 20th century, back when they were just discovering vitamins and discovering nutrients and figuring out requirements. And like, it kind of blows my mind to think that there was a time when we didn't know some of that stuff. During my PhD at UW-Madison, you walk past the building where they discovered vitamin D or vitamin A. It just is, I think that to me is kind of the prototypical nutrition research, and that it's something that's focused on chemical properties and maybe more on an individual animal or within the animal, those processes. So I think like even within the animal organs, tissues, cellular, that level. And I appreciate how you pointed out, you're looking at nutritional management, maybe you're including things, not just the feed that's immediately going into the animal and the urine and feces that's immediately coming out of the animal itself. You're also considering bigger picture, the feed sourcing, storage, preservation, maybe the behavioral aspects associated with feeding, and what they're actually consuming, not just what they're being fed. And then I've gotten more interested with my postdoc too. And then what happens to the manure after it leaves the animal? And I think maybe that's something that nutritionists don't prototypically think of being involved in, but I think they manage that whole chain, or they at least influence parts of the whole chain all the way from feed production to manure management. So I think you said it well, that just a broadening of perspective.
Yeah.
Maybe not just what we're feeding cows versus how we're feeding or animals more generally than just cows.
Yeah. I think a lot of times when we're talking about manure management and sustainability, we immediately jump to, or at least recently, it seems like your first jump is to digesters, right? Mm-hmm. But we know that those aren't a good fit for every farm, especially for our smaller farms. Are there other things that we can be thinking about in between, right? Before we jump straight to, you know, producing methane from digesters, what are some other things that we can be doing for manure management to make a more sustainable farm?
So I think, digesters are probably one that's generated a lot of attention. But like, for instance, a lot of the farms that we work with on research projects now have solid liquid separators, and then are able to manage with a little bit more detail what the solid fraction and the liquid fraction, where those are going. And there's been some research by others at UW-Madison too on the potential for greenhouse gas mitigation with something like solid liquid separation, just because you are able to manage manure in a little bit more fine grained of a way. So I think that that's something that's maybe a slightly more accessible technology than a digester. not as dependent on having a large farm size. You could have like solid liquid separation on a small farm. Then beyond that, I think covers too, like covering up manure storages, any storage that can be covered, you could probably have an impact on emissions just by putting a cover on top of it. So I think those two, at least for the farms that we work with, there's a lot of, I would say, pretty widespread adoption of those technologies in a way that doesn't seem to be dependent so much on farm size.
Yeah. Solid liquid separation, is that a pricey investment? And what's the ROI on that? Or is it just something you do out of the goodness of your heart?
I'm not as involved in like the research on solid liquid separation per se. We just work with a lot of farms that have solid liquid separators and collect manure samples, take them back to campus, and analyze emissions on those samples. So I haven't been involved in like the economic assessment side, but
that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I should have warned you I was going to ask you for a quote before I threw that question at you. But
I'm not that deep in extension yet that I know the prices of everything.
I guess a better way to phrase my question is, what are the benefits of solid liquid separation besides just wanting to like make a greener farm?
You're like a non-monetary benefits or?
Monetary or non-monetary. You say it's a great way to make a farm more sustainable, right? But beyond that, is there anything additional that they bring to the table?
So I think there's a potential to recover bedding so that you can potentially decrease bedding costs if you're using recycled manure solids as bedding instead of purchasing bedding. So that might be one way to reduce costs a little bit. I know some farms have also tried to get a value add there by marketing the solids as, for example, you could compost the solids, market the solids as for people's gardens or for other purposes like that. So there's a potential other revenue stream there, although I'm not honestly sure how much you can make off of a bag of recycled manure solids. But then I think beyond that, just from a handling standpoint, it seems like the liquid separated manure is maybe behaves a little bit better in storage and handling.
And it probably reduces smell.
I'm not sure on the odor side if there's a large benefit to solid liquid separation. I would think so, since you're removing a lot of the organic matter that could potentially produce odors.
Yeah.
But I'm not certain.
Sounds like we have another project for you then. How does how we feed cows impact the manure side? I know you've done some work in like nitrogen and nitrogen cycling. Are you a big believer in like amino acid balancing and low, I hate the term low crude protein diet, right? It's like, but it's more like precision feeding, right? It's precision. First of all, crude protein is not really a great measurement in the first place. It does its job. We understand what it means, but it's really not telling. It's not telling you much about how we're meeting that cow's protein requirement. So like when you say low crude protein, I feel like people think, I don't know. I've just had some conversations with people where they're confused by what you mean when you say low crude protein diet. Mm-hmm. And I think a better term is probably just like precision feeding nitrogen or proteins. So anyway, that was a side tangent. but how do you tie in some of like that nutritional management with manure management and I guess overall climate impacts in production?
I guess I'll start with you mentioned the reactive nitrogen too. I think there's such a clear linkage between protein nutrition and reactive nitrogen outputs that it's almost one of the most tried and true relationships that I think you can find, that if you're feeding too much or the wrong types of nitrogen compounds, basically, to talk about it in the broadest sense, you're going to have more reactive nitrogen in the manure output and potentially worse environmental impacts. So I think it's good that it's so reliable that you can simply by lowering crude protein you can have such an impact on the environmental outputs from a dairy animal. Like my PhD research, we also looked a little bit at the safety margins that you might need. So you talked about precision feeding. I think it's an interesting term, precision feeding, because I think the way you're meaning it, I'm interpreting that you're talking about hitting the requirements exactly.
Yeah.
I did some work in my PhD on oscillating proteins. So we tried to, or we fed cows above and below their requirements at intervals, 48-hour intervals. They changed the diets to go plus or minus 1.8% of dry matter in crude protein. So they were changing quite a bit in crude protein from, I want to say our lowest diet was 12.2 and the highest was something like 16.9% crude protein. We had a factorial design. So even with all that change day to day in crude protein, the cows seem to cope with it. They seem to be pretty resilient to it. So like productivity was similar. Enteric methane emissions were similar across the time varying and the static treatments. Reactive nitrogen output was also similar across the static and time varying treatments. So it seems like maybe the day-to-day variation isn't as impactful. So that you could have a pretty, you have a larger safety margin, I think, than what people might think. So I guess maybe it gets to the question of hitting the requirements. Do you need to also add a safety margin to the requirements? I don't know if we need to overfeed protein also on top of what the requirement is based on some of, like, for example, our recent work that showed that you can have some day-to-day variation and still end up okay in terms of productivity. But where the big difference is, as you mentioned, is just the level of crude protein. If you can feed less, put less nitrogen into the cow, you're going to get less nitrogen out. That seems very basic. But especially in terms of like the reactive nitrogen outputs, we care a lot about managing like urinary urea nitrogen. That responds very sensitively to excess nitrogen in the diet. So what I kind of left off with in my PhD was trying to figure out which groups of animals we can effectively feed less nitrogen to without causing side effects essentially on productivity or other environmental impacts, since there may be some trade-offs with other environmental impacts and reactive nitrogen too.
I want to go back and talk about that study a little bit more as you were and so clarify if I'm not explaining this right or if I misunderstood. So it's, so you oscillated, so every 48 hours you switched, and you said it was like a 16 versus an 18 crude protein.
So we had two levels of crude protein. One was something like 14% and the other was something like 16%, and then those were kind of like the oscillating treatment was plus or minus 1.8% around either of those two levels. So it's a factorial design, two levels and two patterns of crude protein feeding. So we got the effect of both the level and then whether or not it was varying over time, the oscillating or not.
Okay.
That's a bit complex.
Did you see differences between 14 and 16 then?
Yes. So there's a huge difference in nitrogen use efficiency in that the cows fed the lower crude protein were much more nitrogen efficient. They had similar productivity, but they just excreted less urinary nitrogen. So that's the worst case scenario. If you're feeding more nitrogen and it's just all going out in urine, then not really any benefit to feeding protein that way.
So you did see differences between protein level, but you didn't see any interactions with oscillating or not oscillating. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think the implication is that we wanted to test the two protein levels, one that was close to what the expected requirement was, and then one that was just below or like really kind of marginally meeting requirements, something that's almost efficient. And we thought that maybe the cows would be more sensitive to the variation over time when they were fed at a slight deficiency in metabolizable protein, but that doesn't appear to be the case, at least based on that experiment, which given we had 16 cows, so I don't know if it applies in real world settings. I suppose you have more potential complications associated with like managing animals in a group setting versus we fed cows individually, obviously in a research setting. So maybe cows out in the wild would, if you have that much day-to-day variation, maybe they'd experience it more because they would have factors like the bunk competition or things like that that would exacerbate the day-to-day changes.
Well, I mean, I don't want to go too far out on a limb here. This is more conjecture, right? But if you listen to Norman St. Pierre's talk at ADSA this summer, like he kind of said, like cows might be more resilient than we think, right? Like, cause he did a lot of work on variation as well. And I think that I kind of picture it and I, as like the rumen maybe provides some of that buffer. Mm-hmm. Because it's like it's its own kind of ecosystem, right? And so it's adapting while the cow's adapting, right? So I wonder how much that, I think that's really fascinating to think about, like how those things interact with each other. Yeah.
Well, I think that you bring up a good point, and that's kind of why we picked 48 hours for the time interval, because we were guessing that's about the retention time of digesta in the animal. So maybe you have a certain window of time that you can have ups and downs, but it's possible that if you hit 4 days or 5 days with a really low dip in crude protein, maybe that's when they start to have production ramifications. So I think there's still a lot of interesting questions about variation in feeding. There's been a paper too in Journal of Dairy Science last year. Dr. Kelly Nichols, who's at UC Davis now, had something on oscillating protein too, where they did show there was a slight benefit, I think only numerically, not statistically, a benefit to feeding static protein versus oscillating. So I think, to me, the jury's still out on how much we need to care about the day-to-day variation or what types of variation are dangerous versus what is fine. Like you said, what can the buffer of the rumen just cruise us right past?
I think it's one of those things where we have a lot of assumptions, and our assumptions didn't necessarily come from data. And so I think it's important, like some of that research and some of the stuff you talked about with Kelly, making sure that we're like, okay, let's check our assumptions. Let's see if like how this actually does work. So it's certainly an area to kind of keep an eye on.
Yeah. As I've gotten more into, the extension side recently, it's made me wonder, as you just mentioned, about what practices are actually being done and why. I think that'd be a really interesting foray for a future project. You'll look at like how are people actually setting safety margins? Is it based on, how many nutrient analyses are they running, or how often are they reformulating? Stuff like that, I think, hasn't necessarily been described a lot. I guess that's why I would call that part of nutritional management and not so much on the nutrition side. So I think there's still a lot of research questions and probably a lot of very intensive calculations you could do to try and figure out what's optimal for a given farm.
Right. Certainly a really interesting question.
Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together and the first ingredient in animal diets. Priority provides a more cost-effective and easier approach to nutrition. We recognize that not all bacteria are created equal. The specific strain truly matters. Priority IAC selects unique strains to provide the best performance in animals, and that's why we call these strains smart bacteria. Founded by Richard Brunig, helping to improve animal health one herd at a time.
I guess let's take a big step back. We spent a lot of time talking about greenhouse gas emissions. And in general, when we're talking about sustainability stuff, we talk about greenhouse gas emissions. They're the sexy thing, right? But what else besides greenhouse gases What other aspects of sustainability can be influenced by a farm's nutrition program?
The way I try to approach this with teaching sometimes too is that, so you've got climate change, that's only one little part of the environmental sustainability picture. And then you have beyond environmental sustainability, there's the other layers of sustainability. Potentially, if you're using that three pillars model, you could think about also social and economic sustainability. There's a variety of alternatives to the three pillars model, but that's the maybe widest known way of thinking about things beyond just the environment with respect to sustainability. So when it comes to nutrition, I think it's important to remember, like we started to discuss earlier, that nutritionists are orchestrating some really large flows of nutrients. So there's the whole crop to animal to crop cycle that the nutritionists are intervening in by selecting feeds that go into the diet and determining how they're used, and then potentially how those feeds end up in manure that's then reapplied to the crops too, or something else is done with it. So yeah, I think that there's impacts on like the most closely related impacts for nutritionists to be concerned with, in addition to climate, I think would be air and water quality. And I think that a lot relates to the reactive nitrogen outputs, but also there's a variety of other nutrients too that we could be concerned with if we really, you know, I think any nutrient in too large of a quantity could be an environmental concern. So I would hope to see in the future maybe more focus on the entire nutrient cycle and how farms are interacting with the environment that surrounds them.
Yeah, that's really, I feel like we just keep kind of getting bigger and bigger. And I think that is good, because I think a lot of times we, whatever field you're in, right? People really love focusing on their thing. That's scientists, right? Like, you get really passionate about this very small thing and you focus on it and you spend a PhD working on it and you learn more and more about it, right? But we can't forget to take a step back, right? And say, you know, this is how it impacts the whole system. Mm-hmm. Because in reality, like when we talk about sustainability, whether that's, you know, you said it really well, whether that's environmental, social, economic, however you want to look at it, like the system is what actually has the ultimate impact on those things, right? Like, just because we modeled that, you know, if we feed cows this, they're going to have less enteric methane or whatever we're focusing on, doesn't mean that if there's other things within that system that we're not accounting for, the system is what actually is ultimately going to have the impact.
Well, I'm sure that's probably where a lot of your extension questions that come up to, they're probably more system level questions and less like animal level questions, at least that's what I assume.
Yeah.
But I think with, hopefully in the future, we'll see more nutritionists or that like the nutrition oriented people getting more involved in environmental sustainability questions, just because I know that's like the joke that nutritionists already do all the troubleshooting there is to do on a farm. But I think that it's a really natural extension to think about nutritionists getting involved in environmental sustainability work, especially just because there's so many connections between those two. And I guess with respect to the climate footprint, it is, I don't know, I feel kind of optimistic that the dairy industry, I think, is doing a lot of leadership in trying to reduce the climate footprint of production. So
yeah,
hopefully we can get nutritionists on board with not just the enteric emissions that everybody seems to be excited about, but also the other aspects of feed production and manure management impacts that they influence. Because I mean, if you have that's over feed production, enteric emissions, and manure collectively, that's the vast majority of the climate footprint. So I think by touching all of those categories, you're having a big influence as a nutritionist potentially. So hopefully that's something that our new dairy science or dairy nutrition students will also leave understanding.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful note to end on. I do want to teach you something about extension though. So I would say most of my questions are actually weirdly specific. So do you know the classic extension answer?
It depends.
There you go. I didn't have to teach you anything. You already knew it. Yeah. Because that's your first thing you have to ask, right? You get the question and the question might be very specific about something, but then you have to say, okay, let's think bigger and bigger and bigger. And it definitely depends. My response to whatever your question you're asking is going to depend on all these other factors that you have. So the questions might not be system level, but the answers certainly are. So
important distinction.
So before we get into our three questions that all of our guests get, do you have anything we didn't talk about today? Anything to add?
Maybe two things, I guess. So I think this was touched on earlier. You started to bring up other types of impacts beyond the climate impacts we could be concerned with. I would love to see more people care about reactive nitrogen excretion. Mm. I think there's a lot of data that shows that, at least in terms of the U.S. total footprint, the dairy industry is a pretty small contributor to climate impacts, but we're a much larger contributor to the ammonia emissions, for example, or other reactive nitrogen emissions. There's a paper in 2021 by Al Rotz that covered all the details for that. But that's something I would like to see a lot more focus on. If I had my way, I think that's a more concerning environmental issue. Not that we can really rank our environmental concerns, but I think they're research-wise could be more focused on nitrogen too. And also studies integrating multiple environmental impacts together. So hopefully considering not just climate impacts, but also other environmental impacts too. And then I think on the farm level side, I think there's a lot of good things that dairies do for sustainability that aren't necessarily captured in something like a climate footprint or some of our routine ways of measuring and assessing sustainability. So like the farms I've been on recently, you can see the buffer zones, riparian strips, they're doing rotational cropping, they're doing other things with their community. And so I hope to see more maybe research or not even just research, but recognition of some of the positive environmental impacts too. So we talk a lot about negative environmental impacts, but impact, I think, is a general word. I think you could have a positive or negative environmental impact. So although those things I think are harder to quantify, there are sustainability assessments that we can use to try to get some handle on some of the other activities or practices that dairies do that potentially benefit the environment too. So I guess that's my two final things. More nitrogen work, and then also more focus on the farm level complexities or positive effects on the environment too.
Absolutely. I also love that you mentioned community in there too. I think we tend to in our spaces kind of think of dairy farmers as, you know, they're making milk, right? They're doing their work, but as businesses, they're also community leaders and they're also employers, right? So the social impact of dairy production is also huge and very important.
It seems so hard to really quantify or capture some of those things, but I think there are ways we could try to design at least some maybe if it's just a self-report sustainability assessment, or if we're taking some records or otherwise interviewing people on farm, I think there are ways you can try to start to quantify that. So that's also exciting to me too, to think beyond just measuring gases coming off of manure or gases coming out of a cow. We can talk with people on the farm and think about sustainability in that way too. So sustainability assessment, I think, is a really, really broad term.
Absolutely. Very good. Well, I hate to cut us off, but if people want to find more information about what you're working on or what you're up to, is there anywhere that they can find you?
Well, I've been trying to be better about sharing stuff on LinkedIn, so they're welcome to find me on LinkedIn. I guess people can get in touch with me via email as well. umn.edu. So I think if you look up my University of Minnesota website, you'd find my email. Apparently I'm the 3085th Erickson at the University of Minnesota.
I'm sure there are plenty of Ericksons at the University of Minnesota. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love Minnesota. Is still one of those that, like, I feel like a lot of, like, when I got here to Iowa State, I got to be able to pick my username, right? But it seems like Minnesota is still one that keeps doing, like, the first couple letters of your last name and just throw a bunch of numbers on the end. So,
Yep.
I was there for my master's and I was Carpy, I think it was, I don't remember, 370 maybe or something like that. But
well, I'm glad it's not just me.
Yep.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from Affymilk. Visit Affymilk.com to learn more. That's AFIMILK.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Exalit, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Evonik is committed to help supply a growing world population with healthy and affordable animal protein while prioritizing animal welfare, the efficient use of natural resources, and food safety. Evonik's expertise in low-protein diets and supplemental amino acids help ruminant farmers around the globe to enhance feed efficiency, reduce costs, improve animal health, and lower greenhouse gas and nitrogen emissions.
All right, well, let's get in then, and we'll ask you the three questions we ask all of our guests. So the first one is, what is your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
I'm sure a lot of people will say this, but the NASEM book, I think, is fantastic. The Nutrient Requirements of Dairy Cattle, the 2021 version. And I have it right next to me, too. You probably do as well.
I was checking to see. I actually think I have it at my home office right now.
90% of the people on this show probably say this.
So NASEM is a common one.
Large Dairy Herd
Management. Journal of Dairy Science. Yep. Large Dairy Herd Management is another one. And I do have that. The old one is, let's see where, right there on my shelf.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Which is still a very good resource. Even the older version is still a very good resource, I think.
Yeah. So I also have a plug related to that, that if anybody's using the NASEM book to teach, I have a lot of teaching resources that I made. Like during my PhD, I made a whole bunch of teaching resources surrounding the NASEM 2021 model. So I would love it if people want to get in touch with me about teaching with NASEM too, whether it's for undergrad or grad or extension purposes.
Nice. Yeah. I'd love to. Maybe we'll follow up afterwards. All right. So second question is, what is your favorite non-dairy related book or resource?
So I think the most impactful, I was trying to think about what's the most impactful book I've read that's more a life-changing type of thing. Right before I was getting into grad school, I read two books, Learning How to Learn and A Mind for Numbers. Mm. Are you familiar with either of those?
I am not, no.
So they're both books basically on how to learn and how people learn, but in a kind of mindset shifting way. I'm not sure if I just read it at the right time when I needed to or something, but both of those books I absolutely loved and have gone back to reread too. So I would recommend it, especially for maybe if it's somebody who's still trying to figure out the educational system, they have a lot of good tips too.
All right. And the last question we always ask is, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are not successful?
I'm going to say optimism. I think that people who can find or take limited resources and make something better out of it are people I love to meet and work with. So I think maybe analogous to cows upcycling, I love to meet a person who's an upcycler too.
I love that. I think, again, beautiful note to end on. All right. Well, Mary Grace, it was great. It was great chatting with you today, and looking forward to learning more about and seeing some of the stuff you're working on.
Well, thank you so much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.